Welcome back to Tasteland. I am your co-host, Francis Zier.
And I'm Daisy Aliotto.
And we should address the music you would have just heard. If you're a longtime listener, it changed, I think like 3 episodes ago. We got priced out of...
Yeah, as it turns out, we don't have MJ Lenderman money, post MJ Lenderman fame. So
our new song, arguably better, some would say, is Nightlife.
It's different.
Don't insult my friend Nikiso.
I'm not insulting him. I think I'm not saying it's better or worse. I actually really like it, and I'll tell you why in a second.
Okay. Anyways, Nightlife by Chillers, which is the project of my friend Nikiso Peralta. So thank you, Nikiso, for...
Yeah, we're putting you onto something new and psychedelic, and it has resonance with the Nightlife Review, which is one of Dirt's pop-up franchises that we do, and that really endeared me to this song.
And our first episode was with Josh of Night Gallery, the first episode we used it.
Yeah, that's also true. So yeah. I've been listening to it. I added it to my Spotify favorites.
Me too. It's a great song.
It's great. Mm-hmm. You can listen to the full thing on Spotify or Apple Music.
Wherever books are sold. Music.
Yeah. Well, we will be talking about books and music on this episode because we are talking to my friend, Jad Asper. And I actually had to check whether I, you know, with Francis, whether I should disclose that Jad is actually an angel investor in Dirt. He was one of our earliest supporters. He's also the co-founder and CEO of Kudos. And he's affiliated with the Berkman Klein Center for Internet and Society at Harvard, which I did not say with a Boston accent.
Yeah, the Boston accent really came out for one word.
College. It was bad. I listened back and I don't have an excuse. What can I say?
There's no need for an excuse. You're a masshole. Yeah.
You know who else is a masshole?
Tom Brady.
Jeremy Strong.
Oh, true. That was one memorable moment. I did, you know, I don't watch football, but I'll do the
I'm not Bowl. Like other guys.
Look, no, I watch European. Anyways, no, we don't need to get annoying there. But I did watch it. It was enjoyable, exciting game. I feel like I've never been. I don't want to. This is like a dead horse. I don't want to beat. But I've never been less interested in the ads, but more than like recent years or whatever you want to, however you want to frame it. There, I was thinking how like maybe I'm just like 10 years ago when I was like, you know, a bright-eyed, bushy-tailed college student who like wanted to like analyze ads because that's what I did in class or whatever. I was more interested. Maybe that's part of it, but I think now it's just there's more constant ads and like entertainment is advertising and it's all too blurry. So like it's just the Super Bowl ad as a concept is all the less interesting because we're just added out.
You've also seen everything.
True.
Ben worked on an email for one of the accounts at his agency. That's not his primary account, but he helped them out like one time and they had like a Super Bowl ad. So he was like, am I allowed to say I had one? I'm like, yeah, you were clearly an MVP.
Rearrange some punctuation.
So the Jeremy Strong thing. Okay. So he was Dunkin'. In Dunkin' Donuts ad. So I saw a snippet.
Isn't it just Dunkin' now? Actual question.
Well, I don't know.
Anyways, okay, sorry. Anyways.
My Constantinople. So I saw a clip from an interview that he did where he talks about turning his father's Dunkin' order into a one if by land, two if by sea reference. And similar to my epigenetic.
One if by cream, two if by sugar.
Something like that. Like similar to my epigenetic trauma from the Big Dig, that did activate something very deep in my brain. We also used to on Patriot's Day, my mom would make us drive around and roll down the windows. Patriot Day.
What's that?
Patriot Day is, I believe.
Is it related to the football team?
No. Well, everything's related to the football team. Commemorates the day of Paul Revere's ride. My mom would make us drive around and roll down the windows and yell, "The British are coming out the windows."
That's kind of fun.
That
this
you know, just ignited my deep love of history.
Yeah.
And
is that a Massachusetts state holiday?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Did you have a favorite Super Bowl ad, or was it just all?
No. 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 I not at all. You know, the what, you know what was memorable? I had to look up what the term pick six means, but when I don't even know Cooper DeJean, whatever his name is, that was beautiful. That was my Super Bowl ad. This is 30 is not having a favorite Super Bowl ad, but having a favorite Super Bowl play. Much more interesting.
Well, okay, speaking of Dunkin' Donuts, a consumer experience that I had recently is I went to Walmart and mm-hmm. I saw the native Dunkin' Donuts collaboration aisle.
Did you buy it? You did buy it.
I literally gasped out loud when I saw it. I did a and I bought the Boston Cream body wash.
We're going to leave that there because Jad is here, so you can live with that.
I can live with that, for sure. Let him in.
Thank you for joining us.
Yeah, no, thanks for having me. Sorry I'm a couple minutes late.
Oh, no, not at all. Daisy was just telling me about how she bought Dunkin' Donuts native body wash at Walmart, so.
Yep, I did that, and I smell like a donut right now, so I have no regrets.
Is it donut smell?
I mean, it smells about like what you would expect. Like
sugar? I mean,
is it like really sweet or like?
Yeah, I mean, it's a Boston cream, but it kind of just smells like the filling. You know what I mean? I feel like they didn't fully capture the fact that there's like a little chocolate involved. It was that or like strawberry sprinkles, but as we know, I'm from Massachusetts, so I had to go with my roots there.
Their Super Bowl ad was aggressive and interesting. I don't know if you guys saw it.
That's what we were talking about. Yeah. It was one of the more memorable ones. Strong.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I loved it. I loved the like little Starbucks like skirmish going on.
Judd, how much time? I know that you're affiliated with Harvard, but how much time have you spent? Like, did you ever live in Cambridge?
I did. I was there for 3 years. Yeah.
Okay. So you know your way around a Dunkin' Donuts.
Yeah, I do. I do, yeah. I think I've retired from like Dunkin' Donuts coffee days, but yeah, my student days definitely, yeah.
I mean, I was looking at your website where you have like your top three coffee shops in like 10 different cities listed. So, you know, you're more devotion than Dunkin'.
Yes, I think these days for sure. Yeah, I try to be. It's, I'm cultivating my coffee taste still, but yeah. Trying.
I just redid my personal website and now I feel like I have to redo it again because I didn't even think of putting my top 10 coffee shops. Well, the big joke about Dunkin' Donuts is it like comes out different every time. Like there's no consistency in the quality of the product that you're getting. But you know, we all are just rats in a Skinner box. And I think now that everything in society is gambling, maybe that's part of the appeal for people.
Totally. You never know what you're getting. Yeah.
Never.
Exactly. Surprise every time.
Okay. So I do want to jump right into it now.
Yeah,
so,
please.
To quote your profile on the Berkman Klein Center website, it says that your research focuses on the evolution of internet platforms and inverting the internet's personal data model to place individuals in control of their digital identities, which will be probably the major theme of this conversation.
Wow.
But can you like... From the point of like, what do you mean by placing the individual data model as opposed to like the aggregate? And
yeah, Chad, what do you mean by that?
What do you mean by that?
What does that mean? Yeah, I guess like you can frame it in two ways. So one is like, if we think about the internet today, it's a place where we take our data and we give it to lots of apps. Mm-hmm. An inversion of that would be that apps, services, agents come to us and our data. You know, another way of framing it is like we go to lots of different apps and sign their privacy policy. And an inversion of that would be that apps, services, agents come to us and sign our own personal privacy policy. And so that's essentially what I mean by inverting the internet's personal data model. It's sort of a concept of just the individual being the custodian of their data, but also sort of like... being the one that's sort of establishing the grounds of their existence online, and that things are adapting around them, their preferences, their needs, And yeah, we are kind of back to being in the middle of our existence digitally.
This is like, go ahead, Daisy.
Well, I was going to say, one of the things that rankles me about the conversation around AI is people who are really interested in taking an academic approach to artificial intelligence and the degree to which it can mimic human behavior will talk about having like an AI bill of rights, like for the rights of the AI. And I'm like, we don't even have a consumer bill of rights for people that use the internet. You know, it's a really nice thought that we should be kind to our AI companions, but like, we're not even kind to each other.
Yeah. Totally.
Well, okay. So my first thought when I read this, and like the more I read of some of your writing preparing for this, is that like, I love this idea of like centering the individual and individual data rights. And it's like, it's so radical because I don't really see how it's possible. Like there's so many tubes of toothpaste have been spilled that we can't really put back in, right? Like I probably gave away my data like 100 times this morning, you know, to new websites and old, new apps.
200 old. For me.
Yeah. Okay. Well, not
I wake
not
up
a
earlier than Francis. It is.
But like, yeah, how is like this is a great idea. And it's like this ideal that I feel like is so pro human and like, you know, support it. How do we actually make this happen? Like, how do we even start to think about making this happen?
Yeah, no, I mean, totally. It's very idealistic and, you know, so idealistic that it's like, oh, is this even possible? Is sort of a very, very valid follow-up question. And I think, you know, I think the first question is, well, how do we get people to re-aggregate their data in one place? Because you gave it out 100 times this morning, or 200 times if you're Daisy. And so, like, how do we get all of our data in one place? And that place being a place that you have control over. And so that then leads to the question of like, what are the incentives or user stories that will get people to re-aggregate their data in one place? And the answer isn't people caring about privacy, because unfortunately, most people don't care about privacy. And so we need to lead with sort of a utility or fun or something where the outcome is privacy or agency or control. And so that's one thing. I think the other big thing is, you know, a lot of people have tried thinking about like, okay, well, one way of getting my stuff in one place is by building a second brain or tools for thought type stuff, which, you know, is really cool for like all the nerds out there like myself. But most people aren't thinking about, I need a second brain. I need like this tool to help me remember, you know, all my conversations. So many of those ideas, you know, the Obsidians of the world do exist and they do a great job at like retaining, you know, a lot of your information in a place that you have control over, but they're not really like for the masses. They're not going to spread like wildfire.
They're kind of arcane.
They are. They're for the nerds, which is fine.
Is that what you use? Like, how do you personally control your data?
I don't use Obsidian. I'm too lazy. I just use Notion. I don't control my data too much yet. And so those are two things that I think have been blockers, or like, well, what sort of a mass like utility or fun that we can lead with where the outcome of it is, well, all my stuff is now in one place and I have control over it. And if we get there, which is an if we get there, then we have enough data gravity. And that's a concept I really like. We have enough data gravity where we've started to kind of invert the internet's personal data model, where now apps, services, agents want to come to you and all of your stuff pulled through your gravity to your stuff. And at that point, then we can talk about, well, users can like, you know, what are the design patterns for people managing access to their data? How do we move data to these other apps or services in a way where, you know, we can make that other service adapt to you or do things for you? And so that the luxury of that conversation comes once we've solved the problem of putting all your data in one place.
Because there's almost like this radical like rejiggering of what software development is too. If it's like, if the software has to plug into like, you know, 300 million different like privacy contracts, one for each individual that are slightly different. I'm sure, obviously, like in this world, they'd probably be a little more uniform than, wouldn't be 300 different ones for 300 people. But like that's kind of, it kind of is this total disruption of like the entire software business model, right?
Yeah.
Well, last year, go ahead.
No, you go first.
Well, last year we talked about bespoke software, and I feel like that's a conversation that sort of like surfaced on my Twitter. But at least in my world, and probably maybe this is different in your world because of who you are sharing ideas with, but you don't hear as much about bespoke privacy.
No, I think to kind of address both of those points, I mean, I think what you described was sort of this idea of data going to code, whereas what we are describing is code coming to data or adapting to data. Mm-hmm. And I'm not entirely sure what bespoke privacy means, so maybe you'll have to explain that to me. But
me
the
either,
idea,
Chad, me either.
But the
sounds
idea
nice though,
of,
right?
Like,
it sounds nice.
It does. It sounds it sounds bespoke. I love it. But yeah, the idea of like an individual being able to like, you know, through some like, you know, rule set or concierge service, like set rules around what access a service can have so it can do what it needs to do without overexposing, you know, too much about myself. And, you know, those types of like questions of what does that design pattern look like is unknown. Like no one's going to be sitting there with a dashboard being like, yes, you know, share this with, you know, Dunkin' Donuts, and don't share this with Dunkin' Donuts. It'll sort of have to happen, you know, in the background with some view of like what's happening, and I can go in and like adapt and adjust and control. And yeah, that's been sort of a big topic of like research that I've been really interested in, more from like a design perspective, and it's more forward looking. Like we don't have the luxury of thinking about that yet because we're not quite there.
Yeah, I'm thinking of this tweet I saw just the other day. You know, Nikita Beer, the app developer, he's big on Twitter. Mm-hmm. He had some tweet about like, you know, the audience was other developers. He's like, any user who has turned off push notifications is dead to you. Like they shouldn't exist. They aren't in your priorities. You've already lost them. Which I thought was funny as somebody who has turned off push notifications for pretty much everything except for messages and phone calls, right? And even then, most work days I'm on do not disturb, which is like do not disturb is almost do not disturb, and like customizing your push notifications on your phone is maybe one a rudimentary version of bespoke privacy, right? Mm-hmm. Like that is you having some control. And then I'm thinking of what was it 2 years ago now, and now that like Apple made it so like you were the death of the cookie, whatever it was, Apple privacy, where you're not automatically opted into to data sharing. These are these kind of versions of it that like aren't a total flip and disruption of the model, but or like GDPR, CCPA, or whatever it is, the California one too. Like these, you know, it kind of is happening, but it's these piecemeal things, and still the data flows from us to companies and to aggregators, like. Constantly, but there are these like small steps.
100%. I think you brought up Apple, which I think is probably the biggest player that's inverting the internet's personal data model today. Because if you think about kind of on-device storage, like your iPhone right now is a personal data store. You have a lot of stuff on there, and the design patterns around when you download an app and it requests access to photos, and you're like, yep, share these photos, but don't share these. Or share these contacts and don't share these because now we have control over what contacts we're sharing. That is a version of my data being on device and me provisioning access to that data at will to apps, services that come to me and my device. And so I think in many ways, Apple is slowly unseating, you know, the big powerful data aggregators and giving users control over access to their data. But then it's Apple that's sort of the intermediary. Do we want Apple to have more control? Like, probably not. And so, you know, I think you bring up a really good point. I think Apple is starting to establish privacy design patterns that are intuitive. And that's really exciting because then they can be replicated.
So, okay, you use the term data gravity. And maybe I'm misinterpreting what that means, but I'm curious, like, when the gravity of data started to flow into these aggregators, like, when would you say, is it like 20 years ago? What are kind of, I'm assuming that you know the history of this more than I do. Maybe not, but like, when would you mark as like a watershed moment of like when the data floodgates really start to open and aggregation really scales up? Because I'm assuming it's like 20, 25 years ago, around the time that like social media apps come into play.
Yeah, I don't know if there was like a specific moment in time. It's sort of like, you know, all like, what's the term? Like a little bit and then all at once. But it's, I think when we started seeing like massive, massive shifts in power where you can't really do anything without connecting your Google account or like, you know, if you're a small business and you want to, you want to understand users, well, you need to connect to one of these services that people are aggregating data on. When the balance of power really truly shifted exactly, I don't know if I can pinpoint, but I do know that data gravity will shift again when we start seeing, you know, users being able to just show up somewhere and there being enough information for a service to adapt to you or to do things on your behalf. And that's what when we know we have data gravity again as individuals.
I think Facebook was definitely the tipping point for me. Yeah. And because it took things that people were doing automatically and replaced them, like knowing your friend's birthday, where people are now like, oh, there should be an app for that so everyone doesn't have to use Facebook for it. And it's like, what do you think people were doing before? And that sort of thing, Dirt just did a series on gamification. I think that sort of thing becomes a method of behavioral design. I know that like Meta is still tracking things that I do around the web because I was doing a bunch of advertiser research the other day and I reopened Instagram and it was exclusively companies that I had been Googling and looking at their LinkedIn in the ads. And that doesn't, it really doesn't like phase me anymore, but there are times when it becomes a form of interpersonal behavior design. Like a few summers ago, I was at a party and I was talking to somebody else about a problem I was having with my friend. Let's call her X. I had been trying to get in touch with X. X wasn't responding. Not Elon's X. And I reopened Instagram and X's most recent Instagram post was at the top of my feed in the sense that I feel like my phone was listening to me. I was next to my phone when I was having this conversation. Yeah. I was saying this person's name repeatedly. They're at the top of my Instagram. And that's not that crazy. That happens to me a lot. Actually, when I have these conversations with friends about other people, they come to the top of my Instagram feed. What was crazy about it was within, I think, you know, the next 24 hours, I got a text from Max saying, I'm really sorry I haven't responded to you, da, da, da. And I suspect what happened was that I went on the top of their feed. They felt guilty that so much time had passed and they reached out. Like there was no part of me that was like, wow, what a crazy cosmic coincidence. I actually think what happened is I came up on their Instagram and they realized we hadn't talked. And that's it's weird to feel like you're part of a matrix in that way. I was happy. But I also felt like, oh, how is this feed acting on me and my interpersonal relationships? And I feel that I'm in control of these dynamics, but maybe I'm not.
Totally. But I think you just described sort of like, you know, the structure is serving you in some way. Like you got value out of the ambient tracking of your stuff and it's surfacing. You know, I don't know if that's necessarily like, there's probably a part of it that feels weird because of the lack of transparency and the lack of control. Or maybe that can be alleviated if a user had a little bit more of a view of how their stuff is being used or why something was happening. But I think that same level of like spontaneity and value should continue to happen, because that's like a beautiful moment, like what you 100%.
But if I could set my own privacy contract, if there was a clause that was like, would you like your phone's microphone to listen to you gossip about your other friends and then put that person at the top of your Instagram feed, to the extent where you like finish the conversation, you turn around the phone and show the person that you're talking to, and you're like, classic.
Because it's a lack of
I would not like that. And also, especially if that like shows me to them, because there is like a weird reciprocity also that I think happens in these.
You should be able to go back to the system and be like, this was weird, system. Like, well, why did this happen? And,
if you always see somebody, there's so much conversation. I don't know if you've been privy to this, if this is like a female thing, which is like, there's so much conversation about like who appears earliest in your stories. And part of it is like, well, if somebody appears earliest, that means they're getting served your story very soon after you post it. And for a long time, it was like, okay, these must be people that you interact with a lot or look at your profile a lot. But sometimes there's somebody truly random in there. And set aside this idea that this person has like some sort of parasocial relationship with you that you're not aware of. Like, if you repeatedly see somebody watching your story, you start to believe that that person is maybe closer to you than you already knew. Like, you might start to think of them as a close friend, a visible friend, somebody that you're in touch with, when really you're not in touch with them at all. And there, most of the conversation is around like, oh, does this person that I have a crush on or has a crush on me, like, what does it mean? But like, what does it mean for these weird long-term platonic relationships or acquaintances where like, I start to think, I've really actually kept pretty good touch with this person from college. Meanwhile, I haven't talked to them in 2 years. We just like watch each other's stories pretty regularly.
I haven't looked at that in years. I actually forgot that that was a thing you could do.
Well, I don't want to gender this, but
no, I mean, I used to like when I was, when I was younger and I like, and I did want to know like, oh, who was watching my story or whatever. But like, that is something that I have unlearned, that I just don't need to do. And it's, I almost think that it's, as a feature, it's kind of a harmful antisocial feature when we bring it back up, because what is it doing but giving you information to read into without really knowing the truth? And again, like without knowing like how this person was shown your story or why they were showing it early, like it is like conspiracy fodder for private conspiracies about your life. That's like
private conspiracies about your life. That is a rich topic. I actually really love that phrasing, because I have a lot of private conspiracies about my life. And I would say if you're checking who viewed your story, you're already concerned about something. You might not be acknowledging it to yourself, but there's no truly
it's a symptom of something bad.
There's no truly unbothered person that's looking at that. And it could be something as simple as like, is this person mad at me? But I don't know, Jad. You haven't talked in like
bit. No. This is fun. I want to hear about all the private conspiracies now. But no, I think the like people say like having a view of someone's For You page is like staring into their soul, right? Like you can see.
I want to look at mine. Wait, should we all look
deep
at ours
into
right
someone's
now?
Soul? Like mine's gonna be mainly businessy stuff, like kind of like work related.
So you say.
Let's see.
I've recently taken to maintaining mine more and like mass selecting, like you if you hold down something and you click like not interested in seeing just on the main feed, then you can go and you can select. So I've been trying to curate it more. That's something too that like I can't even remember when that became a feature, and it feels like it wasn't that long ago. Like the Reels based explore page in particular. It must have been like 4 years ago now, or 3 years ago, maybe only two.
Yeah, I mean, there's this really big trend around people being able to like control their feed. I mean, if you look at Blue Sky now with like the marketplace of algorithms, right? This idea that like I want to subscribe to the dirt feed algorithm, right? Yeah. That sort of like will tailor my feed to whatever dirt thing.
Are you talking about Grays? I tried to set one up and it was too stupid.
Well, I did when I joined Blue Sky, or when I followed Dirt and Blue Sky or something like that. I remember there was like the I could follow the package of like Dirt contributors.
I did make a pack, but there's a way to do an algorithm too, and I couldn't figure it out. And I was like, you know what? I think the pack is enough because my algorithm would be like follow these people. I don't feel I need to set a lot of rules around it. So supporting my phone is listening to me story. My explore page is like people who we've found on Tasteland.
Nice.
And Kylie Jenner. But
nice. I mean, there's this interesting concept of being able to like, can I get a high level summary of Daisy's FYP regularly? Like, can I get a high level summary of like, I don't know, someone's FYP regularly where I can like, can I jump into your FYP and like go get into your, you know, your rabbit hole?
Right. Use Instagram as Daisy.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I feel like that's a pretty good transition into, want to do the transition, Francis?
The one thing I was going to say is, I do want to do it. You're right. The explore page is your revealed preferences, but then shelf is your kind of, it's less revealed preferences than it is chosen preferences of like what you're consuming. Whereas like the explore page is the unconscious. Shelf is the conscious. Thank you for giving me back that thunder, Daisy.
Thank you, Carl Jung. Is it Jung or Jung?
I say Jung.
No idea.
It's German, Jung. Right?
Yeah.
Carl is that Jung. How you would say it? German?
Jung. Yeah. I would say like Jung.
Funny though. I think that's right. But then when I see like Jungian, I want to pronounce it Jungian.
Okay, well, it's definitely not that.
All right, well, I'm glad that we cleared that up. So anyway, Chad, tell us what shelf is.
Yeah, sure. So I mentioned earlier.
He's like, the look of regret on your face. Like, why did I do this podcast?
No, this is fun. I like this. It feels like we're just hanging out, which is that's great.
We are.
Yeah. So shelf, you know, I talked a little earlier about like, well, what are the incentives or user stories that will get someone to aggregate their stuff in one place that they eventually have control over? And, you know, shelf was sort of the answer to that question. We actually built like 40 things before shelf, and most of those things didn't work. And they were all us like trying to figure out, like, how do we get people to put their stuff in one place?
And this was all built through Kudos.
Yes, this is all built through Kudos.
And how much of the backend was shared?
Great question. Quite a bit was reused. But we end up, like, as we started validating things, we were rebuilding, you know, things from scratch. But yeah, the kind of like main flash light bulb moment was essentially a metaphor. And that metaphor was the bookshelf. Like, if you think of a bookshelf, it's like a store of all of your stuff. And, you know, there's sort of a sense of peace of looking over and be like, oh, my stuff is here. I know where it is. But also, like, it doubles as a display of your taste. Like, if you walked into my living room and looked at my bookshelf, yeah, it's a mirror of myself. Shelf, self, one letter apart. And if you picked up, picked a book off my shelf and we had, you know, we'd have a conversation about it. And so the kind of, like, context around one's bookshelf became the inspiration for shelf. And the idea is essentially it's a place for you to track everything you're consuming, what you're watching, what you're reading, what you're listening to, the games you're playing, and it sort of puts it all in one place so that you can like have a reference for yourself of everything you've consumed, but also it's sort of self-reflective. You can learn about yourself, and then you can also curate a public display of your taste. And so you can like go to my shelf today, see what I'm watching, what episode I'm on The Black Doves, how many times I've listened to Chapel Roan this week. And you can choose to like get updates. So like if I started a new book, you could find out, you know, what book I'm reading. If we're both playing the same game, you get notified so we can like, you know, go play the game together. And that became like the core utility or fun that we've led with the eventual goal of allowing users to aggregate all their consumption, all their insights, interests in one place, and to get that data gravity that will over time allow us to kind of make shelf more like a really sexy data manager so that we can get to a point where you can provision access to your data at will to all these services and, you know, have truly personalized experiences, truly agentic experiences. But that's downstream. And yeah, like that that's a little bit of what Shelf is. And, you know, you mentioned maybe just to end and I'll pause is, you know, this kind of core concept of like how curated is one's taste or identity and how authentic should we make the experience so that you can, you know, Daisy might say she's watching Black Doves, but actually she's watching Real Housewives. Like, should we allow Daisy to say that? Or should, you know,
to protect her taste, as it were.
Right, exactly. And so that's been like a
really
nuanced
question. I stand behind my taste.
That's so a couple of things that reminds me of. One is like my first thought when I started looking into it was it's like you know, I used to do Last.fm scrabbling in college. Yep. And it's like that where it's kind of aggregating multiple sources into the one. Or also like early Facebook when I remember when I was in like ninth grade making my account and it's like, what's your favorite book? And you can put all those things. But then that's just one part of a much larger thing. And the last thing though, kind of where you were going at the end there and like how, you know, another thing could plug into it and access this data that you've aggregated about yourself for yourself is those terrible Salesforce commercials that they're at the Super Bowl. I've been seeing them for a couple months now too, where it's like Matthew McConaughey and Woody Harrelson. Matthew McConaughey is like that when one he's at some shop in like some small town and the shopkeep is dressing him up in these, you know, this outlandish outfit. And he's like, oh yeah, this shop isn't connected with Salesforce's AI. So they didn't know what I wanted. But that's like a use case I'm getting from Shelf is like a possible future is like any kind of like thing that any app or product that takes in personal data to act on it and like give you an experience, then that's like your data credit card that you can plug into them.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And yeah, it's like there's so many analogies here, like your digital passport, your USB with all of your stuff that you can plug into things.
It's your exactly all the data that Google has on you, except you own it.
Exactly. It's your personal context. And I think more than just the personal context, it's also the access to the platforms and services. Because a lot of these like, you know, agentic use cases are like, we're going to go order sneakers for you. Like, just tell us when you want to order sneakers. Well, you need to know my size. You need to know where I live. You need to know my preferences for sneakers. But you also need access to my Amazon account so you can go actually purchase the sneaker. Like if you tried playing around with Operator, like OpenAI's one of their latest releases, like they don't necessarily have access to a lot of these apps or services or platforms where you do things. And so, you know, part of what we're doing with Shelf is we're also helping users store their credentials in one place. Because when you connect to Amazon, we're storing your Amazon credentials for you. And that allows you to also not just like get personal context to like serve things on, you know, the end of the service, but allow the service to actually go do things for you, which, you know, I would describe as like, you know, even bigger of an opportunity. And so, yeah, that's the downstream idea, but like, we try not to get ahead of ourselves. Like, you know, I think it's fun to talk about that. And we certainly are, you know, researching that and engaging with that on an intellectual level. And also on like a technical level, because there's a lot of big open questions still around what does personal data storage architecture look like? How does one transport data between two services and maintain privacy? Is it at the level of inference or is it at the level of the data? People think it's at the level of the inference. And like trying to stay on top of things there. But what we're trying to solve for today is how do we just make Shelf part of culture? Like how can you have as much of yourself on your shelf? And how do we just serve you and make it a really valuable utility for you? And that's the kind of main thing that we've been focused on to date.
That makes sense.
Okay, one thing I wanted to say about Shelf and like how, because I downloaded it this morning and I started, you know, I'm like, okay, like I put my song in and then I didn't get too far though. But I was like, okay, here's how I can like track my things. But I'm thinking of my own personal like media consumption tracking, right? I use Letterboxd. I don't use Goodreads. I have like an Apple Note where I write down the books I've read. And then like TV, like looking at it, I know like you suggest using Netflix to track, but that is such a fraught one, because like I live with my fiance and we both have, we, you know, on the TV, we've got our shared Netflix. We've got like, you know, I think we use like a Disney Plus that's like my sister's and like all that kind of thing. And then I'm also watching, I'm on like YouTube TV watching soccer games. And that's probably my blah, blah, blah. Like a long way of saying like, it's so convoluted and so cross-platform and sometimes manual. And like, I don't use Kindle. I don't read eBooks. I read physical books and I write it in a note. So I think to me, that's the challenge as like a potential user is like, how does this make my life better to like consolidate my media consumption tracking and do more manual work around that, right? Like that's the challenge I'm curious about as a user.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's a big question. I think, you know, the balance for us has been like, how much do we scrubble and then how much do we allow users to add? Because there's no API to like the movies you watch in the cinema, right? Like there's no, like, unfortunately, no API to physical books yet. And so, like, to what degree can we support users in helping with some of the tracking?
Yeah.
And then how can they correct and fill out what's missing? And so I think getting as much coverage as possible of, like, the places where you do consume. You know, Netflix is one of many streaming platforms. And, like, can we get as much coverage as possible there? But then also can we round the corners with, like, you being able to... you know, to specify like the profile, like your profile versus your partner's profile, which we do today. So you know, you don't have to, it's not all of your, I use, like, I think my sister's Netflix account, but I have my own profile. Like I'm not, you know, tracking my sister's stuff. And then, yeah, like, you know, you might be watching, you know, we have parents who use their Spotify account on shelf. So it's like, you know, Peppa Pig soundtrack. And obviously that's not what they're into. So can we like correct for that? So there's definitely some complexity there with like getting as close as possible to allowing you to passively track, while giving you the tool set to, you know, actively add and curate and do all of that. And that really, you know, what the friction, we need to minimize the friction. We need to maximize the value you're getting out of doing that. And so, is that value for you to learn about yourself, to have a reference? Is that value so that Daisy can keep up with you effectively? Mm-hmm. And like you care about letting Daisy in on what you're up to? Is it that you can... He does. Okay, cool.
In a book clubbing type of function.
Right. Yeah, maybe. Maybe there's sort of a book clubbing type of function. And so it's the balance of minimizing friction and maximizing incentive or utility on the other end. Yeah.
Are there any numbers that you can share about how people are using Shelf or anything that surprised you?
Yeah. So we have like 1.5 billion data points now, where a data point is something like Daisy watched Severance Season 2, Episode 1 on Monday.
I did do that. Not on Monday, okay, though.
Cool. I was stalking you on Shelf. No, I'm joking. That would be so bad. and yeah, I think that number is very large, and that just sort of speaks to how much people consume. Like on average, I think per user we have like thousands and thousands of like rows of like consumption. So I think just the sheer amount of consumption people do is like surprising to me. I think the other big thing is just like people really care about like proving how big of a fan they are of something or how early they are to something. And that's been like a really interesting kind of like incentive to work with. Like, you know, can we help users prove that they were really early to an artist? Or
it's like in a Web3 type of way.
Yeah, but not in the like get a PoE up or NFT type of thing.
Well, what's the most popular integration outside integration into Shelf?
I mean, Spotify is by far the biggest one. So today, yeah.
I'm thinking of like the way I use Letterboxd or my notes app of books is like when I'm at a party and I'm talking to someone and it's like, what have you been up to recently? Like, what have you been? And I don't remember. Right. And I used to, 10 years ago, I would have remembered exactly the last three books I've read and the last 10 albums I've been obsessed with. But now I don't, because I don't have to. So I pull up my phone. Yeah. I'm like, well, what have I been listening to? What have I been watching? Yeah. I think like Shelf makes that more interesting, because instead of pulling up Letterboxd and then notes and et cetera, it's like you just have it all right there. And then you're able to talk to these things, like the different themes you've been consuming. Yeah. More specifically, I'm also another, did either of you watch Didi, that movie?
No.
So there's a scene where it's set in like, this is like 2008 or seven or whatever. The kid would be like 13 or something. And he has this crush and he is talking to her on AIM, and he like goes on her AIM profile or her MySpace or whatever. Like, what are her favorite movies? Cause she asks like, oh, what movies are you into? And he picks one of her favorite movies that he's never seen before, but he, you know, he's like, oh, I like this movie. And I'm like, that's one way I'm thinking of Shelf. Or even like in a couple of weeks ago, we interviewed somebody and I like was like, oh, what can I find on this person? And she'd written about mm-hmm. Goodreads and I found her Goodreads. And I like, we asked a couple of questions about like mm-hmm. specific books she read. So yeah. That's like, to me, like it becomes not necessarily a social media in that way, but like a primary source for information totally. About a person that you can use to communicate with them.
Absolutely.
And like learn more about them. Going into
conversation, I don't know. That is one of our goals. I mean, we see people using it kind of like a link tree for their interests, like the link to their shelf.
Oh, that's good.
And, you know, it's sort of a dynamic view of what they're into right now. Like, it's similar to how I have my coffee list on my website. Lots of people have a book list on their website. And so we do see like podcasters kind of starting to use it as a way of like, they'll talk about a book on their podcast and they'll link to their shelf so that their audience mm-hmm. can go and like keep up with what else they're doing, where they're at in the book, et cetera. And like one thing, I kind of a dream feature of mine is me being able to like tap phones with Daisy and like immediately see mm-hmm. what we have in common, mm-hmm. where it's like, damn, you're both really into this genre, this niche genre. You've both listened to this podcast and you've, you know, recently watched this movie. Well, that
here's how many you've read 300 books, she's read 700 books, here's how many of them overlap. Like, yeah,
exactly. Yeah,
you and gotta,
like, we can just jump straight into that. So
do you know Winnie at chipped is
I don't either
acrylic nails company that puts an NFC chip into one of the nails and you tap into mm. somebody's phone and it gives you your social profiles.
Mm. Wow.
So you should do a Shelf X chipped integration.
That's so cool.
But I've been watching Winnie and like from afar being like, hey, this is pretty cool. I guess like one thing that came to mind when you were talking, Francis, is before the internet there would be like two phases of conversation of getting to know somebody and their media consumption habits, which is like, what do you like is the first phase. And then mm-hmm. why is the second phase.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And now we've made all of these ways for people to signal what they like. But part of the problem is you would think that would get easier to skip to the why, but so much of the focus is on the curation that actually we don't get to the why. Mm. And because it's just, I have 10 different platforms to say what I like. And by the time I'm done doing that, I'll have nothing else left to say.
Like, I'm looking at your shelf right now.
Yeah.
See that, okay. Your top genre right now is Bedroom Soul. Mm-hmm. You're listening to Lenny's podcast, watching Severance. Mm-hmm. And it's like, those are all then kind of data points that like, theoretically you could, or like, you know, an AI, whatever, could extrapolate what are the ideas behind these, what are the you know, connect it to like what are the people who made these things, their accounts on social media, what are they engaging with, and like, you know, a million data points you could put in about like who are these people, what are their ideologies, and then like how do they relate, how do the ideologies behind your favorite musicians relate to your favorite shows. Then you start to get into some why where it could like fit out what's your worldview. But that's also antithetical to this idea of data privacy and something I think that shouldn't happen. Like that would be a massive invasion of privacy for so many parties on so many levels.
Yeah. I think the kind of what you're referencing here is like inferences made based on the what should be made transparently. Like what I really love about like some of the more recent developments in like, you know, AI bots like DeepSeek describing why it's making, you know, the decision it's making or the judgment it's making, kind of the, you know, the like stream of logic is, it's transparent. Like I can see the biases more clearly, etc. Mm-hmm. So I think there's value in that. And I think the other cool thing is that because there's so many models, like you can funnel, you know, the what into different models and see the whys, like the inferences and their differences kind of across them as well. But I think what you're hitting on is like, and maybe this is where we can take the conversation is like, you know, there's the flat view of like what you're consuming and what's missing is the context around it. I think that's what you were getting to, Daisy, is like, what's the context? And how do we start to sort of unravel the context so that that's part of the picture and the narrative and the story? And I don't think we do a good job of that today with Shelf. And a big part of the reason for that is we haven't cracked how to allow people to add that context in a way that's low friction enough.
Well, this is a theme on this podcast, yeah, is low friction culture. And in this situation, I actually think like for an app developer, you do want to create that low friction, but for the actual function and the social connection, maybe, yeah, the high friction is actually good. And it's in the figuring, agreed, out and like having to have conversations with these people about why you like this thing and make those connections yourself. Like maybe that is like actually the spark and that's what's valuable. To automate that and productize that actually degrades what's like good and magical about these conversations. Like the why is something you have to arrive to together in conversation with a person.
I agree.
If you skip to it through a product, then like you're just drinking Soylent and not even getting any of the nutrients.
Totally agree. I think like the high friction why allows you to then associate more meaning with the thing, right?
Yeah.
Like you put in time and effort to generate the insight and to put it down and to express it. But I think that associating that only with like really momentous things, like if this was like you just discovered this artist and she made you cry and like it was a thing that's worth adding context to, then sure, that high friction, you know, is probably like you can make there's a reason to doing that. But you know, the YouTube video you just watched and like, you know, whatever, it's like on, you know, it's the algorithm just surfacing things to you. You're probably not going to invest a lot of time adding the context. Like maybe there's a reason where we can prompt you in a way to reflect and put something down.
But the context maybe was so algorithmic too. And like you weren't even thinking it was just delivered, right, to you. And it's the next thing, yeah, you click on.
So I think playing with friction is definitely a big theme for us too, is like what's the right level of friction to unlock meaning and like a sense of accomplishment, but not to burden the user. Like how do we balance burden with like sense of like, yeah, meaning making. And it's a very, very hard problem. And like, it depends on the context of the various things we're working on. To be unraveled.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think a higher level of experiencing something is not only to log it or even rate it, because there's a lot, yeah, of people who use Letterboxd where like they'll give something a star rating or they'll give a book a Goodreads rating, but mm-hmm. they won't necessarily write anything about it. Mm-hmm. Like,
yeah,
feeling compelled to write something about it is a whole other impulse.
Totally.
I'm sure as you build out Shelf, like right now, like I can add as many things as I want, but only six will display at a time, right?
Right.
So yeah, there is already sort of a hierarchy to it. And
yeah,
as you go along, you could add a hierarchy where things that are highly valued with meaning require additional context. But I also like by having an editorial arm of Shelf as well, and I was recently profiled, that's also a way to add context and like meta context for the project like as a whole.
Exactly.
And we talk about that a lot on this podcast too, that's kind of the function of media.
Are there things that like aren't in Shelf right now that you would want to add? Like we were talking about YouTube for a second, like we're almost implying like, do you add like your most recent YouTube video you watch, your favorite YouTube, and then it's like,
yeah,
your favorite Instagram account that, or like the Instagram account you've, I don't know, so many other things you can add where it's like, where do you stop and why?
Totally. Yeah. I mean, the main framework that we use today is, there's two main frameworks. The first is we're focused heavily on the present self, not necessarily on all time phase, because the present self evolves and becomes past. And so like when you go into someone's shelf, it's not necessarily their favorites. It's like what they're up to or into right now. But obviously, if you want sort of a picture of someone, it's not just what they're into right now. You also need that higher level view of, you know, what is really meaningful to them. And that's missing today from shelf. I think the other big framework is like we think in verbs. So like watching, reading, listening, playing are the main verbs that we support today. And watching includes YouTube. I mean, YouTube's also listening because a lot of people, you know, listen to stuff on YouTube. And, you know, you can actually add YouTube stuff today on shelf. There's no YouTube connection, but you can add things manually. And really the hope is that we can extend beyond those verbs. And we don't restrict what links you can add manually. So we've seen people add everything from like the hot sauce that they're into this week to like, you know, the mascara they bought and have been wearing. And so, you know, I think there's the concept of a shelf is extensible. The concept of one's taste and what they're into and consumption and activity is also extensible. And for us to really get to a point where it's a holistic view of the self, for you, for shelf to be a view of oneself, we need to expand beyond the current verbs. And so that is very much within kind of what we're trying to build.
I tried to pitch Chad on doing a Fragrantica integration, but I think I'm just going to start manually adding my perfume, see if anyone catches on.
Yeah.
another thing I'm jumping to is like how is Perfectly Imperfect's website and their whole motto, a taste of one's taste, where like that then is the so abstracted version where it's not based on verbs. It's like purely based, they purely traffic in vibes over there. And I actually haven't used their website, but
do you use the app though?
They have an app?
Yeah.
No.
Yeah. I have not used the app version. I noticed that yesterday.
I love research. Perfectly Imperfect. I think they've really been excellent at being very highbrow and the sort of approach that they've taken and really targeted the sort of elite tastemakers, if you will.
But if everyone's a tastemaker, then nobody is.
Right. Yeah. Word.
On that note, no, I'm just kidding.
No, that's
Francis and I are sort of in like an unstated competition to end the.
Like you just the lost podcast. You lost the competition by not ending it there.
No. Well, no. Anyway, this is Tasteland. We'll see you next week.
Peace. Thanks for coming
on. Thanks for having me. Bye.